football on off the ball.
We just don't have the climate that you can play in the winter. Mm. And we just don't have the climate that gets any sort of quality. We don't have the facilities to accommodate that. So it's only right that it would be from through the summer months.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
All right, you're very welcome along to the press area. This is where the press conferences happen here at the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield. Lots of shiny lights, hence why there's a light bouncing off our foreheads. But there's philosophical questions that people ask, that, you know, what happens after we die? Is life out there in the universe? And where's the cue ball going is another one, I think. And the man sitting beside me might know the answer to that one. It's John Virgo, of course, the renowned snooker commentator, 1979 UK champion. John, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, yeah. Do you think it's taking on that significance?
You know what? It's one of those ones that people think about. But I heard it actually, we were just coming back from one of the semi-final sessions. You managed to sneak it into the last frame as well.
I try to sneak it in most frames, but I think it just, if there's a few people dozing off, you know, just to spring them back to life and get them looking at the snooker table, yeah, it's important.
I want to bring you back a bit, John, to your upbringing. Obviously, you're a Salford boy just outside Manchester. Yeah, yeah. I'd read somewhere that obviously you would have played in Potter's clubs and that sort of thing as a child. Within 6 months to 12 months of picking up a cue, you were boys' champion of Great Britain. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And, it was life-changing, really, because, you know, I mean, you go to school, you play football, you play rugby, cricket. But to find something you're good at, it takes over your life. So I won the boys' championship when I the under-16s. I won the youth championship, the under-18s. But unfortunately, there was no money in the game. So there was no ever thought, was that a young lad today of turning professional, that was a no-no, you know. And you just got a job and played in the local leagues and all that. So thought of turning professional was never a thought. And it all changed, of course, when Cover Television, Pop Black, Ray Reardon, John Spencer turned professional, joined this elite club that a lot of people was a closed shop. And then, of course, Alex Higgins came along, added that sprinkle of stardust and got people watching the game. And that's what we needed. And in the early years when we came to the Crucible, it was a completely different atmosphere because it wasn't so much the prize money. We were trying to sell the game to people, and nobody sold it better than Alex Higgins.
I brought this up with Dennis Taylor yesterday, and you obviously turned pro in 1976, so I guess just before the dawn of snooker becoming this massive worldwide thing. What was snooker like in the 70s? I put this question to Dennis as well. Obviously, you had, looking at old videos, you've got, you know, people sitting on beer crates, dodgy characters left, right and centre in the rooms, the generators powering the electricity, no natural light to be seen anywhere. But what was snooker like back then?
Well, I think snooker from its roots was a working class game. I mean, you can go back further than that when they had the temperance snooker clubs, and that was basically for people who were unemployed, you know, just after the 1926 general strike, a temperance club where they could go and, like a community centre, you know. So that is the sort of grassroots of snooker. But for it to become as popular as it did, I don't think anyone ever imagined that. You know, we remember the days of Joe Davis playing on Grandstand and all that. But I think colour television, as I say, was very important because the colours, you know, the green bays and the different colours of the balls, that's what added to it. And then the BBC getting involved with Pop Black. And then that attracted people. And then we got, as I say, the likes of Alex Higgins. And then we've had Jimmy White since, which was a offshoot of that, if you like. And then Ronnie, who's carrying on that great tradition of not only playing the game, but making it look exciting. But when you look back at the 70s, I remember when I won the UK Championship, and my first prize was £4,500. And my pal said, "You'll never be skint again." Well, he was wrong, I promise you. But when you compare it now, this year, the winner getting £500,000, and word has it, in a 2 or 3 years' time, we're talking maybe £1 million for the winner. That will encourage, hopefully, a new generation of snooker players.
sport's come a long way for sure. You referenced your 1979 UK Championship win, and for those who are familiar with snooker, they'll know that the UK Championship, the Masters and the World Championship are the three major titles, as it were. There was a couple of incidents in that 1979 UK Championship final that you won against Terry Griffiths that were quite extraordinary. I mean, I sitting at the Crucible earlier this afternoon, and the media seats look brilliant seats in the Crucible Arena. You're right behind the cameramen and you can see the work that they do. There are no camera shots of your 1979 UK Championship win, and can you tell us why that was?
Well, first of all, they'd been playing the afternoon sessions at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but with it being a Saturday grandstand, they'd moved it forward an hour. But I can only blame myself. I can't blame my manager at the time. Mistook the start time, so I got there 40 minutes late. Was deducted 2 frames, so instead of leading 11-7, it's now 11-9. He wins the next 2 frames. Terry Griffiths, it was, who was the reigning world champion. I'd lost in the semi-final 6 months previous to Dennis, and he'd lost in the final to Terry. So then he'd pulled back. It's now 11-0. I'm at the interval. You know, I'm in my head's in a jar, I've got to be honest with you. And then when we come out after the interval, because it was first to 14, best of 27, I'm playing and I'm looking at the cameras, and they were the old cameras, you know, that looked like Daleks, but nobody's manning them. Anyway, after the frame, which I'm scraped through and won, I said, what's happening? He said, they've gone on strike, the BBC. So, yeah, I mean, just everything happened. It was the best and worst day of my life, you know. But that is life, isn't it? You know, and how I won it, I don't know. I went 13-12 behind and won the next 2 frames. I think I got to a point where I thought, well, you know, it's just not going to happen now. And maybe that just relaxed me, freed up the cue arm, and I did have the needle with myself as well. So that probably helped, and managed to win.
I can imagine. You referenced a man there who, I guess, you know, there aren't many sports people who are so iconic in their sport that the sport was so in need of them. Like Seve Ballesteros, I know you've mentioned before in golf.
Maybe
Michael Schumacher in Formula One, someone to that of that level. But Alex Higgins, this is a man who I know you were very friendly with, passed away very soon in 2010. Obviously, multiple health issues over the years with him as well. But Alex was a friend of yours. There was a video that I came across recently on YouTube, and it was, if you search on YouTube, John Virgo versus Alex Higgins, private match footage. You played him in a frame of snooker.
I did.
And there was a pink up the rails, and there was a one-handed black into the middle pocket, and it was just extraordinary footage. But who was the Alex Higgins that you knew, I guess?
Well, you just said I was very friendly with him. I'd have loved to have been very friendly with him. Because
friendly might be the wrong word.
Yeah, I mean, and Jimmy White and I were great friends, you know, we talk about it, you know, but Alex could turn on a sixpence, you know. But we absolutely idolised the way he played the game. He ruined my game for 18 months. I make no mystery of that. I mean, when I first saw him play, I was still an amateur when he won the World Championship in 72. He came at the snooker club where I practised. To come and practice with me, I'd never met him before, you know, and he came, you fancy a game, babe, you know, and all that. And I played him 64 frames, and I was just amazed at the speed around the table and the way he made breaks. And as I say, for 18 months, you know, I was still an amateur. I was trying to play like Alex Higgins. I just loved the way he played. It was inspirational. But yeah, we did have one or two run-ins, you know, but I always remember when we got the seniors tour together, which seems to be building more and more, and it was a vehicle for Alex and Jimmy, actually. But Alex was very poorly at the time, and he only did one of them, and we did it here at the Crucible. And I've introduced him, you know, 1972, 1982 champion of the world, Alex Hurricane Higgins, and he came on with a fedora, and he sort of beckoned me over to him. And I thought, oh, what's happening here? And I went over, and he kissed me on the cheek. And that is that will be my lasting memory. All the other annoying things he'd done were forgotten in that split second, you know. So, yeah, maybe he had respect for me, and he had as much respect for me as I had for him, and he liked me as much as I idolised him, you know. And that little peck on the cheek just maybe confirmed it, but he'd never tell you.
There was another anecdote, and I think it was yourself that told this story before, that kind of shows the soft side of Alex Higgins, and it involved, I think, you visiting his digs. It could have been Manchester, or it could have been, I know he lived in Blackburn for a while as well, but it involved cheese. Can you tell us that story?
Well, that was when he first came over. He was living in a place near Blackpool called Oswald Twissell, and he just won the World Championship. And he sort of invited me round to his flat, you know, and it was just smothered the floor. It was like one of those things when you'd forgot to tell the postman you were away, you know, when he'd been away 6 months. It was cool with telegrams and everything else, but under the cabinet, I noticed there was a mouse trap with a bit of cheese on, you know. So I said, oh, you got a mouse? He said, yeah, he said, but the trap's not set. I just like to keep it well fed. So, yeah, that was typical Alex, you know.
Animal welfare was important to him, obviously. I've seen the videos of, obviously, you did impersonations of players throughout the 80s, in breaks of play or at the start or end of sessions. Some incredible impersonations of players and their temperament around the table and the way they hit shots, the way they celebrated shots. It all led into, I guess, you getting the role with Jim Davidson on Big Break.
It did. It's amazing what you do in your life. And you never know where it can go. When I used to do the impersonation, and obviously, good material, you know, you got the likes of Alex, Ray Reardon, Terry Griffiths. And I used to do them for a bit of fun. And then all of a sudden, one year at the Crucible, I think it was about 1986 when Joe Johnson won it, there was a semi-final finished earlier. And the promoter then, Mike Watterson, who found the Crucible Theatre, who died recently, sadly, he said, would you go out and do some of those impersonations that I've heard you do? So I went, yeah, okay. And I always remember David Vine coming up to me afterwards and he went, you know, you've just got £25,000 worth of free publicity there. As it turned out, thankfully, it was a lot more. But anyway, but it did get me Big Break. I'm certain of that. The producers said, we saw you do those impersonations. Jim Davison said he saw me do that. He said, that's really funny. And that's why they thought I could be a foil with Jim when we did Big Break. So there you go.
The success of the show, I think it started off on a Tuesday night perhaps and was moved to a Saturday night.
It filled in the slot that Question of Sport had held. And the first week we got more viewers than Question of Sport.
And then 14 million at its peak?
At its peak on a Saturday night, it peaked at 13.9 million, which is incredible. And just shows you how popular snooker is with the British public, you know. And, it was amazing. And Gary Wilson, who's in the semi-final here now, the producers got a letter from his parents asking could he come on the show. And when he was 8, he came on Big Break.
Really?
As an 8-year-old. Mark Selby played in the junior Big Breaks. So yeah, it was a grounding and got them used to playing in front of TV cameras, which you wouldn't have done normally.
Did you think phrases like say goodnight JV and pot as many balls as you can, would people would still remember them years on? I mean, it's 17 years since the show ended, but it was an iconic show for so many, and I guess because it was, 91 to 02, you're talking a lot of 11 years, so it's a lot of people's childhood there as well, so a lot of people remember it.
Yeah, so many people say that we'd be getting ready to go out on a Saturday night, you know, and that was their TV, you know. I think what happened, I was working with Jim Davison, and I didn't really know Jim Davison. I had a manager at the time, and he said, and it's a bit of good advice for everybody, really. He was the star of the show, and he said, well, don't compete with him. So I sort of went into this deadpan expression, you know. So when they'd say to me, he'd say, what's the rules, John? And I'd just say, pot as many balls as you can. Sort of not wanting to make light of it, just do it straight, you know. And then eventually they said we finished up with the chemistry, which I think we did. Now, how that works in life, I don't know. He's a crafty Cockney conservative comedian. I'm a dour Northern socialist. But so where does that chemistry come from? You don't know, you know. But it did work, and it was 10 of the best years of my life. And one of the funniest men I've ever worked with, and one of the most generous men I've ever worked with. And after mixing with Alex over the years, I could handle him. because there wasn't a lot of difference off the set, you know.
Your book is one of the books that, you know, I would encourage a lot of people to pick up and read your autobiography. I know you're doing a signing, I think, in Sheffield.
Tomorrow morning. Yeah.
I mean, it says it in the blurb of the book. You go from highs of rubbing shoulders with royalty and flying on the Concorde to the dark days of the gambling. And you know, I think it was it the 82 World Championship where you made as much money in a day at the Chester Races as the world champion got that year?
Yeah, it was the year that Alex beat Ray Reardon in the final, you know, that iconic moment. Probably the first sportsman ever, I think, to get his wife and baby on, you know. But yeah, Steve Davis, who got beat by Tony Knowles in the first round, Terry Griffiths, who got beat, and I was installed as favourite. But I had a four-day break. I went to Chester race courses, backed the winner of the Chester Cup, backed the winner of the Cheshire Oaks, and won more money than I would get in for winning the tournament. But it just ruined my karma. I came back to the practice room and couldn't pot a ball, you know, and finished up getting beat by Ray Reardon in the second round, I think. But it was just, you know, you think, when will you ever learn? But as I say, we were brought up in a different era. I mean, now, I mean, people say to me, how would Alex Higgins cope with today? He'd have had to have reined in because he wouldn't have been able to get the results. You know, you cannot now party and then come. You got to remember, in those early days, it was only two tournaments, three tournaments, if you include the invitation to the Masters, as you say. So you had 3 months off in between tournaments where you'd be playing exhibitions and the like. Excuse me. But nowadays, it's tournament after tournament after tournament. So Alex would have had to have reined himself in. And and I'm a great believer. If you've got the ability and the class that he had, he'd have competed in any era. He'd have been a different character, probably, you know. But he'd have been a player in any era.
Jimmy White's another one who has competed in many eras, and we got the news yesterday, on Wednesday afternoon from Barry Hearn to say that he would be playing for another 2 years on the tour. How did you react to that news? And I guess, well, it's great news for Jimmy, and it's great news for fans of the sport as well.
I don't know. I'm a bit undecided about it. I've had a few discussions with Jimmy about it, you know. Jimmy White was one of the great, or is. I'll say was, because that would be the honest, if you want my honest opinion. But one of the greatest players of all time. The fact he's never won the World Championship is a terrible thing, you know, when you look back. I'm not certain he should take the tour card, to be honest with you. He's getting beat in the qualifiers. He doesn't very rarely get to the television stage. He deserves better than that. Now, he'll turn to me and say, well, I enjoy the game, I love the game, I like to practice. And that I understand. But 2 years on the tour, travelling all around the world, not getting to the television stage, maybe one tournament a year, is that how we want to remember Jimmy White? Or does he concentrate on the seniors tour and win there and help build that? And he could be a pivotal person to have in the seniors, the world seniors, you know, along with Stephen Hendry and the like. So, yeah, I have mixed emotions about whether he should take the tour card. But it's his decision at the end of the day, and it's his life, you know. But I don't treat it with any great joy, if you ask me my honest opinion.
Don't want to keep you much longer, John. You're keeping busy yourself. I've been looking at your on your Twitter. You have the Trick Shot app. You've got a range of waistcoats, I think, as well. Hence why I'm wearing a dodgy shirt this afternoon. It was in tribute to your decorative waistcoats. But you've been kept busy. You do a bit of panto as well. Do you enjoy that?
I did do panto. I did it with Jim Davis, and I couldn't do it now, and I wouldn't do it now anymore. I've got to be honest with you, that was hard work, but it's great, great fun, you know.
Oh, no, it's not.
Oh, yes, it was. And as I say, working with Jim Davison was just special. It was just fun all the time. It was fun. And, those moments of doing big break, panto, you know, they resurrected my career, because when you're playing snooker and you start missing blacks off the spot, you think, what am I going to do? I know I had the commentary for the BBC, and you'd get the exhibition because of the impersonations, but that wasn't going to keep me going forever. You know, you need to re-establish your name, and Big Break did that. So I had a second chance, really, at, if you like, making a name for myself. And thankfully, it still continues.
A lot of people I know enjoy your commentary in the BBC. I sat down with Clive Tyldesley quite recently, the renowned football commentator, of course, and he was telling me, I was kind of asking him about his commentary preparation for a big match. Of course, he did the 1999 Champions League final, Liverpool winning the Champions League in 05 as well in Istanbul. But he was kind of saying the only part that he prepares for and maybe scripts is the part from the team's walk out to kick off, because you can kind of predict what's going to happen in that period, but once the game starts, anything can happen. How do you approach your commentary? Do you have any idea of what you're going to say in the build-up to the match? Do you kind of just go on reactions, or how do you approach it?
Well, unlike Clive, I mean, he's got a lot of names to remember, particularly if you're playing a foreign side. I mean, I only have two names to remember, and sometimes the referee, which can be a little bit tricky. I suppose the only way I prepare, I look at the match and see what I think is the weakness of the two players and how I think it could play out in the match. The rest of it, I've got to be honest with you, I just love the game. I love snooker. It's given me everything in my life, you know. It's taken me out the back streets of Salford and taken me around the world. I love the game. I love watching the game. And I just feel delighted to be there, you know. So I don't really go into it too much. I just call it as I see it, you know.
Well, a lot of people who enjoy your commentary and your trick shots and exhibitions as well can see you in action. Well, Dennis Taylor is going to be playing against Ken Doherty for three nights in Ireland, so I've got the dates of them here. So Friday, May 17th, you're in the Hillgrove Hotel in Monaghan Town. Saturday the 18th, the Shearwater Hotel in Ballinasloe, and then Sunday the 19th of May, you're in the Talbot Hotel in Stillorgan. So three nights in a row, tickets on ticketstop.ie, and you can get them directly from the hotels as well. So there should be some enjoyable nights, I'd imagine.
Well, we always have a laugh, but the danger is in the bar afterwards, when we have the crack, as Ken calls it. So, we really look forward to it. And listen, I couldn't think of a better place to go than Ireland, and they're two of my closest friends in the game.
John Virgo, it's been a pleasure. Say goodnight, JV.
Say goodnight, JV.